The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
You're listening to a selection from the Word of Mouth archives.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Here's a surprising statistic. More murders were solved by police departments in 1995 than were committed in 2014. So on one hand, that's a good thing. The number of murders and violent crimes in general have gone down significantly in the past 20 years. On the other hand, the percentage of murders being solved has not improved. The question is why, given the lighter caseloads, more precise forensics, and more tools to follow a criminal's digital footprint? At a time when mistrust between police and citizens clashed in many of the nation's communities, Dara Lind looked into how those tensions may affect the rate of homicides being solved. She's a staff writer for Vox who covers criminal justice. And Dara Lind, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me on.
So violent crimes have been dropping over the past 25 years. How significantly?
The violent crime rate has basically fallen in half since the early 1990s. Over the 80s and 90s, it was incredibly high. People were very worried about it. That's where you have the war on drugs, war on crime, crack epidemic fears. And then quietly throughout the 1990s, without a whole lot of people really, even in the academic and policy world realizing it, it started what's now become a quarter century long trend. And it was really until the turn of the century that academics started taking it seriously. And even now, with about 15 to 20 years of research into why crime has gone down, there isn't really a clear explanation as to how much of it is changes in how police operate, whether putting more people in prison really did bring crime down, whether it's things like the economy or stuff totally out of left field, like reducing lead in paint. It's a massively important social phenomenon that no one fully understands, even as it's continued.
Well, we should note, as you do in your article, that there has been a sharp jump in homicide rates in 2015 in several big cities. Any theories as to why that may be?
In the same sense that it took several years to figure out that there's been a 25-year decline in crime, a lot of academics are really wary of saying, oh, there's this big spike that must mean that crime is on the rise again. No one can quite yet say whether this is just what you would call noise in the data and strange things happen to be happening, or whether there really is something that's connecting these cities and that might portend for a continued increase in violent crime. Some of the theories that have been thrown out are pretty clearly politically motivated. On the one hand, you have people saying that because of recent protests over police treatment of young black men, people no longer trust police, and therefore criminals know they can operate with impunity. You have people, on the other hand, saying that police don't care about policing communities, and therefore criminals are coming in and filling the gap. Both of those seem a little bit more politically motivated than motivated by facts, but it's definitely the case that a lot of cities that never really saw quite as much of a decline in violent crime as the rest of the country did have seen a spike back up in 2015.
But you do write about the relationship between policing and community. Baltimore is an example where in the early 1990s, 70% of murder cases ended in arrests, while 2014 only 45% did. Now, this is a city that went through a lot of turmoil and a lot of scrutiny this year. What's your takeaway of that?
So this is really tricky because at the macro level, it's really tempting to say any change in crime rates is because of a change in policing. And because there's so much else that goes into crime, and it's such a more complicated social phenomenon than just a criminal justice phenomenon, that's almost always an overstatement. But then at the micro level, when you look at what goes into solving individual crimes and how does solving individual crimes impact whether people are likely to trust the police and go to them in the future, that there's a really strong connection. The Baltimore Sun, actually, it's police department invited reporters to come embed with them in a homicide investigation because reporters there had been very dismissive of how police were acting toward the community. And the police said, if you don't think we're doing a good job, come with us and we're going to show you how hard it is. And what they reported at the end of last year was totally consistent with what people who have done other reporting on homicides in major cities have shown, that people know in the community know who committed the murder, and they don't talk to the police about it because they're afraid of retaliation from the murderers or the murderer's accomplices. They don't believe that the police are capable of protecting them, and they believe that the police are more interested in busting them for minor offenses than they are in busting people who kill members of their community. And that's not just something that you see consistently when people do reporting all over the country, but it's something that you see when there are analyses of how do you solve a murder case. Two of the most important variables are being able to talk to a reliable witness at the crime scene and being able to go around and talk to the victim's friends and family and, you know, colleagues and any of that. Those are two of the factors that are most highly correlated with finally being able to crack the case. And when you don't have people who are willing to talk to you because they simply don't feel that it's worth it to their personal safety, then it's extremely difficult to be able to make any progress, even in a case where you know that everyone who's talking to you knows what who did it and won't tell you.
Well, so eye-opening, given, you know, all that we've heard about how forensics and DNA evidence and cell phones and GPS, you know, the kind of following the digital footprint of criminals, all of these things in the law enforcement toolkit, but you're saying that it goes back to community relationships.
Right. I think when you're talking about policing, it's useful to remember that police have to do two things. They have to both solve crimes that have occurred and prevent future crimes from occurring. And at the most, you know, 10,000-foot level, most police departments have made the decision that preventing crimes is a more efficient use of their resources than solving them. The other thing is that ballistics and forensics are useful, but they're not everything. And, you know, if you talk to lawyers, once a case goes to court, they'll joke about the CSI effect, where a lot of people who aren't familiar with the criminal justice system assume that every case is going to have clear physical evidence that's going to tell us exactly who did it. And often that's not true.
We're speaking with Dara Lind. She covers criminal justice for Vox and has looked into why, when there are fewer murders being committed now than in the past 20 or 25 years, fewer of these cases actually get solved or cleared. Well, Dara, how many murders do end in arrest?
The general clearance rate is somewhere around 60 to 65%. That's going to vary depending on whether you're talking about a large or small police department. The biggest cities actually have, they're at the higher end of that range, and then medium-sized and small cities tend to be a little bit lower. That varies across cities tremendously. In Baltimore, even before this past year when it's been terrible, the clearance rate for homicides was fewer than 50%. And that's a big change from 25 years ago when there were many more homicides happening, but many more of them were getting cleared. Nationally, as the homicide rate and the violent crime rate have dropped, the clearance rate has stayed pretty flat. About 60% of homicides got cleared, which means somebody got fingered for them, or they just determined that the murderer was killed, so there wasn't anyone to arrest for the case anyway. In 1990, about 60% of homicides are getting cleared in 2015. That means that obviously more homicides by number got cleared in 1990 because there were more homicides happening.
Is it really surprising that the percentage of murders that are solved hasn't changed? I mean, it makes sense given that there are fewer murders. Police are solving fewer murders.
There's a certain argument out there that as murder rates have gone down, the murders that have remained are in the neighborhoods and social contexts that were always going to be the hardest to police anyway. And because of that, you know, it makes perfect sense that we're not solving the same, you know, the same crimes that wouldn't have been solved 25 years ago aren't being solved now. I think the strongest argument against that is places like Baltimore, where you really did have a big drop in the number of homicides that were getting cleared. The other argument against it is that homicide detectives who were working during this period, especially in the really big cities, were so overwhelmed by cases that it was honestly a miracle that they got through those years. It's the amount of strain on urban police departments was so ridiculous that if you compare it to now where they're getting so many fewer cases across the transom, yeah, it's kind of insane that with so much more time to be able to devote to a case, that doesn't mean anything in terms of progress. Mm. Or, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that more cases are going to get solved. I think it's also, like, the most crime trends have not been as flat over the last 25 years as this has. Right. More people were getting arrested for murder from 1990 to 2000. And then after 2000, arrest rates per murders dropped. That changed more than clearance rates did. The number of people who got arrested for murder who got convicted rose consistently, as it did for every crime, over the last 25 years. There definitely are changes in how these things are being investigated and prosecuted, but clearance rates are the one thing that is staying stubbornly consistent.
Caseloads at police departments may have diminished somewhat, but community scrutiny is certainly amped up, especially in metropolitan areas. And municipalities and police departments are working really hard to improve the relationships between the communities and the police, between police departments and the communities that they're supposed to be serving. So where do you think this is going, Dara? Do you think the trend is showing that cases are going to be solved with community help more in the future?
If you're trying to figure out whether police are going to be able to rebuild trust with communities, looking at homicide clearance rates is probably not going to be the first thing that changes, right? That's probably going to be something that changes as a result of a lot of other issues getting solved first. And there's not a clear answer to how you rebuild community trust. It seems very obvious that doing things wrong for either a short or long amount of time can destroy community trust very quickly. There isn't as much evidence as to how that improves again. And even if you have, you know, leadership that is very invested in changing the relationship between the police and the community, actually turning that into an institutional priority when you have police who have been told for, you know, a couple of decades that the things that are most important are the things that can be quantified, which are arrests. That kind of culture clash is something that is not new to this particular issue, and I don't think it's something that's going to get immediately fixed.
Well, Dara Lind, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Dara Lind, she's staff writer at Vox, where she covers criminal justice, and you can find a link to read her article and a lot of infographics that show you a little more about this picture. The article is called Police Are Solving a Lot Fewer Murder Cases Than They Used To. Link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Hi, I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is an archived edition of Word of Mouth. Officials in New Hampshire estimate that the number of deaths due to drugs surpassed 400 by the end of 2015. That's about 1 in 3,000 residents. And while the numbers are shocking, it is the lives and the families behind those numbers that Anne-Marie Zanfania, an artist from Plastow, is focusing on. When Anne-Marie lost her 25-year-old daughter, Jacqueline, in October of 2014, the first line of her obituary in the local paper made it plain. Jackie died from an accidental overdose after being sober for 11 months. Anne-Marie refused to be shamed by the disease of addiction, and after struggling to get through the following 6 months, channeled her anger and sadness into a project that has helped other families cope with loss. She began painting portraits of young people killed by drug overdoses in the state, and she's brought several in to show us. They are vibrant, colorful, and beautiful. And Anne-Marie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
You can tell me as much as you'd like to of this, but I'm looking at this portrait of your daughter, Jacqueline. Jacqueline, beautiful young woman. What happened to her?
She was beautiful, no doubt about it. And she knew it. But I think when she was younger, she was maybe struggling with behavioral issues that never got addressed. Although I brought her to many doctors, psychiatrists, in counseling, out of counseling, her whole life. And I tried to get her into a rehab, but she wasn't ready. And I found out about almost maybe 9 months before she died that she was taking heroin. Mm-hmm. and we had a family intervention. I asked her to move out because she was having none of it, and she did. But we keep in touch because I always kept her cell phone on. And then she moved back home again, and things were going really well. She got a job. She got a new car and a new boyfriend. We thought life is good.
Right.
We thought our prayers are answered. But it had been a difficult struggle, you know, because when you have a child that is on drugs, there's lots of other things you deal with.
Right.
You deal with the police. You deal with your own possessions. Where are they?
Yeah, I've heard a lot about that kind of thing.
And it's sad. But I went to, I've been going to a therapist when, well, before Jackie overdosed the first time. And so, and I had been grieving Jackie for that whole year before she died. Because I know that if you take heroin, you usually die.
And she was lost to you, I guess, on some level anyway, if she's addicted.
Right. And the therapist, you know, was explaining to me that the brain chemistry changes yes. totally. And that's something I think a lot of people don't understand. But I had that explained to me so that I could, you know, make some sense of what was going on.
So it felt more like a disease than a moral failing, which I think is what a lot of people get upset about, you know, that they think that somehow they failed, that it's not about brain chemistry and drugs answering an addiction.
Well, I knew it wasn't that. You know, we have a good family, a good support system. She was raised well and had, you know, whatever basically she wanted.
How old was she when she died?
She was 25.
Oh, I'm so sorry. So you started with her portrait, making
yes.
her portrait. Did you plan on doing others at that time?
No.
How many have you done now?
I'm working on my sixth one.
Well, I'm looking at, you brought them in, and you're generous to bring them in for us to see them, but I'm just struck at how young, vibrant. I mean, obviously you're taking portraits of pictures that are, you know, people posing for them. They want to look good. How did you choose these subjects?
I met parents
yeah.
or wives or loved ones, and they got me a picture. Sometimes I can pull pictures off of Facebooks because to do this, I put the original picture through a computer program,
mm-hmm.
and it comes out with color and the shape. And then I draw it and paint it.
Mm-hmm. You do the shading. They're very, if I can use the word, kind of Warholian. You know, there's
yes.
there's not a lot of shading distinction, very bold kind of colors.
Well, it's called posterization.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm wondering, you know, as you're doing these portraits of these people, you may not have known them at all. What's going through your mind?
The pain of their family. My pain. It doesn't go away. But I feel like I'm bringing attention right now to the problem. And that's a mission of mine.
Mm, yeah.
Also, it helps the family members heal a little better because it's not your regular portrait. This is a joyful painting because of the colors I choose. And so they have something that would make them happy.
The response here in New Hampshire and other places, some talk of policy changes, some talk of recovery centers, you know, getting tighter on fentanyl. What role does art play in this discussion of the heroin crisis?
Art brings attention. You see people here, even though they're brightly colored. These are all our children. And when you put a face to a statistic, I think it makes a big difference. This is not just number, 300 that died. This is a person, someone who had a mother and a father, children, you never know. And we have to honor them. Something terrible happened to them, and they died from heroin. And I don't want to let Jackie die, This keeps her with me. It keeps us with their families.
Well, it's an overwhelmingly moving thing to see. And Anne-Marie, I just want to thank you so much for coming all this way and bringing them with you.
You're welcome.
Anne-Marie Zanfania, she's a New Hampshire-based artist. She's begun painting portraits of people who have died due to drug overdoses here in the state. You can see photographs of some of her portraits at wordofmouthradio.org. You're listening to a selection from the Word of Mouth Archives.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. People have always enjoyed a love story, but up until very recently, our ancestors didn't live one. Historically, marriage was founded less on passion than pragmatism. Then romantic love became the benchmark, supported by countless novels, pop songs, and rom-coms. Now we approach finding a mate with bigger expectations and heavier pressure than ever, while always moving, feeling too busy or isolated to get there. How to Choose a Partner is a new book by Susan Quilliam that offers guidance, practical exercises, and research on the patterns and influences that affect the decisions we make about love. It is not The Rules, but the latest from the School of Life series, which draws from the humanities and psychology and science to approach life's most profound questions. Susan Quilliam is on the faculty at the School of Life. She's a relationship psychologist, author of more than 20 books, and sex and relationship agony aunt for Fabulous Magazine in Britain. And today, our relationship guide. Susan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good afternoon, Virginia. Delighted to be here.
Well, you write in the book that you were thinking of calling it How to Choose a Partnership rather than How to Choose a Partner. So what's the distinction?
Well, we tend, when we're finding love and we're looking for love, we tend to look at the person. We tend to do all the tick boxes, as in online dating. And we think, oh, yes, Mr. Right or Ms. Right. Actually, it's not as simple as that. And at the same time, it's much simpler because almost any two people can be compatible if they create the right relationship together. And there are a lot of people out there who can create the right partnership for any of us. So we need to be focusing on what we create, the experience of being with that person, not just whether they tick all the boxes.
And that requires a kind of collaboration. It means it calls upon you and what you can bring to it too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the points I make very clearly in the book is that you're not just, or you should not just, be looking at what the other person, what the potential partner can give you. You also need to look at what you're giving them, what you're motivated to give them. If after an evening together, you're feeling exhausted and feeling you really don't care how they feel, that's not a good omen.
Well, you make that point from the historian Stephanie Kuntz that our ancestors did not live a love story, that there were practical matches based on status and connection. Then that shifted to romance. And now we have this search for a soulmate. Is that a realistic expectation?
Largely no, because we can't give each other everything. Up until the mid-years of the last century, love was not expected to be all. God was there for that. God gave us unconditional love and we were expected to repay the favour. But nowadays, being human, we still expect to deliver love and to have love delivered to us 100%, 24/7, 365. And as you've just said, Virginia, up to very recently, that wasn't the expectation we put on love. It's a big ask for everybody.
So most people do still envision the love that they want as a goal for the future. Now, you suggest going back, not only to your most recent relationships, but the distant, formative past. What are we looking for there?
Well, a lot of our patterns around love, a lot of our needs, a lot of what we expect, a lot of what we are able to give, they're formed in quite early childhood. There's some lovely experiments done with very little ones, 18-month-olds and their mothers, about how the children reacted when they didn't feel loved. And we carry these patterns forward into our adult life. You know, we can withdraw if we don't feel loved. We can almost literally throw a temper tantrum. We can cling on and hope that it all works out. And of course, our prospective partner is going to be doing the same. So we bring all of this to the table when we form a new relationship. We bring all of it when we choose a partner. And in return, our chosen partner is bringing all of their past history. We don't really take that into account as much as we should. It's not the present that matters as much as what we bring into the present.
Well, say after making that consideration, we are ready to take the plunge. And of course, many people now, online dating has lost its, I'm going to say, loser stigma, I think, that used to come along with it. It gives people so many choices to investigate other people. But you have a chapter in the book about not choosing. What do you mean by that? Are we just leaving this all to chance?
Well, we can leave it to chance, and sometimes chance delivers, you know, Lady Luck delivers for us. But remember that there's a long tradition in human society of the people who are partnering, the people who are marrying, not making the choice for themselves because they're seen as not experienced enough. It's seen as the family and society see them from the outside. They take two people and they match them together. And very, very often this works out. I mean, of course, often it doesn't. But when I'm teaching classes on how to choose a partner, very often I ask the people in the class, well, what did your parents do? What did your grandparents do? And often there are some very touching stories of love literally after first sight. So the first time people have met is on their wedding day, but love grows from there. So that's one way of not choosing. But the other thing is, well, too much choice is actually counterproductive. There's a lovely, lovely experiment where people are asked to choose. Well, this is about jam, but they repeated the experiment with speed dating. They're asked to choose between 6 sorts of jam and 24 sorts of jam. And in fact, they found it easier to choose with 6 than they did with 24, even though it looks like they have more choice, that it might be easier to choose with more. But we get confused, our minds start worrying, we wonder whether there's a better partner over the horizon. So sometimes having too much choice, having our choice limited, or not being able to choose, directs us into a better decision.
Okay, so say you do narrow it down to 6 types of jam
yes.
Online. But online, people don't always present their most authentic selves. You know, we show the, as somebody put it to me, my profile online is as if produced by my agent, you know, their best self. So how do you get to know what is the right kind of jam for you?
Well, I always advise in my classes and with my coaching clients at the School of Life, I always advise that as long as you have a basic compatibility, you know, you both want kids or neither of you smokes or you have the same religious upbringing, religious preference, that you speak as soon as possible on the phone, you video Skype if you can, you meet as soon as you can, because it may look great on paper, the tick boxes may all align, but it's not until you actually meet face to face, virtually sometimes, you know, on the phone sometimes, it's not unless you have a real life connection that you can tell whether you feel comfortable with that person. So I always suggest that people do that as soon as possible. And in fact, some recent research suggests that if you leave it more than 23 days of emailing, as many people online do, you're bound to be disappointed because your expectations will be so sky high. You'll have been holding your breath for so long that the relationship probably won't work anyway.
So that actually makes Tinder a good option. You just immediately plunge in and meet somebody that's in your proximity.
Well, interestingly, although Tinder has somewhat of a reputation for, shall we say, quick liaisons, I have a number of clients who have met on Tinder and have formed long-lasting relationships. So it could be that it is working that way. But you bring up another really interesting point, Virginia, which is what sort of relationship do we want? You know, if the sort of relationship that we're heading for is different from the sort of relationship that another person is heading for, then it isn't going to work anyway. And you need to check that out before you dive in.
My guest is Susan Quilliam. She's a relationship psychologist and author of How to Choose a Partner. It's a new book from the School of Life. She's on the faculty at the School of Life and teaches courses about dating better and exploring in depth how we make love choices and steps to make our search for love more effective. Well, Susan, one of the most enlightening things for me in the book was this chapter on connecting and this essential concept of emotional responsiveness. Now, what is that and why is it so critical?
Well, this is based on the work of a psychologist called Sue Johnston. And what she says makes every sense and is the basis for an awful lot of therapeutic approaches nowadays. And that is the idea that what we want from a partner may not be a good home or even a good family. It's whether they can respond to us when we need them. And Sue Johnston sums it up beautifully. Are you there for me? And can I be there for you? We're not talking about every minute of every day, but if there's a crisis or even, you know, a small wobble, if we turn to our partner, are they going to give us attention? Are they going to give us support in the way we need? And as I mentioned earlier, the other crucial question is, are we able to offer them support? Are we motivated? Do we want to help them? Do we want to be there for them?
I think, you know, that kind of reciprocity, it shifts things away from this focus on the consumer model of I found someone or I'm getting a partner. And again, brings up that question of whether we are good for them. I don't know, Susan, I don't know if a lot of people think about relationships in that way, do they?
Well, certainly the classes I teach and the clients I see are usually very, very focused, very intelligent, bringing an awful lot of emotional intelligence. But you have to remember that we have only been dealing with partner search, partner choice, very, very recently. I mean, over the last few decades, as opposed to the last few millennia, where we have, you know, partnered up for marriage. So we're still learning, we're still getting up to speed on what it takes to choose a partner for ourselves in current society. And even in the last few years that I've been working in the field, we've learned a lot, but there's still an awful lot more to learn.
Well, you are suggesting that we are teachable about this. And of course, a lot of people want to learn how to find a partner. And I guess what I'm hearing from you is learn to be a better partner in the process. As you talked about earlier, we have this kind of imprint in the way that relationships go. You know, I think for a lot of people of my generation, we saw our parents not always in self-actualized partnerships, but they weren't aware that that was a requirement. Do you know what I mean? Like, most of us do not have a lot of great models in our lives of real partnerships.
We don't. And if those real partnerships are in our lives, they don't usually, as you've just said, talk about it. You know, how many parents sit their children down and say, you know, we're happy together, but we've had our rough times. And when we've had our rough times, this is how we've got through them. We just don't have that conversation. Love is almost more private than sexuality nowadays. And one of the really interesting exercises we do at the School of Life is we spend probably an hour or so looking at our past, but also looking at the media, at the lessons we've learned at school, at the lessons we've learned through our culture, the lessons we've learned from our peers, the lessons we've learned from our families, and put together a picture of, well, What are our expectations of love and partnership? And very often, those models, as you've just said, they're not so much shallow as they're missing. You know, take a simple example from the media. Almost every book, almost every film presents an ideal of romance that is quite far removed from what we experience in a normal relationship. That phrase, they lived happily ever after, has an awful lot to answer for when it comes to making a real-life human relationship work.
Susan, you revised The Joy of Sex. There was a modern update in 2008 for, you know, more modern sensibilities. We haven't really talked about sex and sexuality and the role that that plays in a partnership. Is that like the idea of soulmate no longer the soul guide?
I think it is no longer the soul guide, or it is no longer the soul guide for many people. But in partnership, there are very few people who initially and at the start are willing and happy to have a relationship without sexuality. But of course, one of the big challenges later on, perhaps after children, perhaps as you know, you get older, is that sexuality in your relationship may die away. Sometimes it will just diminish, other times it will disappear entirely from no fault of your own. So one of the things that we're learning is that lust alone does not make for a long-term partnership. That said, the ability to lust probably lasts longer in our generation, you know, in our society, than it ever has done in the past, simply because we have better healthcare, we have more expectations about enjoying sex as we get older, and we have encouragement and permission to do so.
Susan Quilliam, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure, Virginia.
Susan Quilliam, a relationship psychologist and author of more than 20 books, including most recently How to Choose a Partner. It's a new book from the School of Life series. You find links to more on the book and to the School of Life website, which has a toolkit, including Who Should I Be With? It is a card game designed to sharpen our sense of what we should be looking for in love. Links are at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came from Jazar, Tyler Gibbons, Poddington Bear, and Kevin MacLeod. There's loads more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. Until next time, I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.